Goldstein, it's good to see you again. Thank you for letting us come back again. My name, as you know, is James Balter, and my partner is Gene Simon. We are here to interview you, a continuing interview, for the oral history collection of the Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women. Today is Tuesday, December 12th, 1989. And would you tell us your name and address?
Earth date. Because we have Darren's voice, too.
You want to redo that?
Your name and birth date.
I'm Samuel J. Goldstein, residing at 12H Chatham Towers in the city of Pittsburgh. Born on 10/4/1025/04 in Washington County, Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Goldstein, your story of how you're cleaning the gravestones at the cemetery is fascinating, and I think you're performing a real service to the community now and in the future. Someone may wish to visit the cemetery that's not familiar with the area or the cemetery. Could you be good enough to give us directions to the cemetery?
I'd be very happy to do that. The cemetery is located on the border in the borough of McKees Rocks near the township of Stowe, at or about the location of the Stowe Rocks High School. That's STO-ROX. To visit the cemetery, proceed over the Fort Pitt Bridge onto West Carson Street, about 3 miles or thereabouts, to a turn off to the left into the borough of McKees Rocks. Going through the borough on Charters Avenue, a distance of about a mile, you come to an intersection known as Greydon, G-R-E-Y-D-O-N Street, and Charters Avenue. The landmark would be a McDermott funeral home on the left side of the street. Making a right turn to the end of the street, which is about a square and a half, then a right turn on Vine Street, yes, about a block to the top of the hill, which is the location of the cemetery. It extends covers an area of about 5 acres and encompasses about one city block, the original land having been purchased in 1873, and then subsequently the Beth Jacob congregation bought an adjoining tract of land used as a cemetery. And together they were combined in or about 1960 to form the Beth Amedrus or Gottel Beth Jacob Cemetery. The total area consists of 5 separate purchases of land, and as I said before, covers an area of about 5 acres. There is available, if you want me to tell you this, available for burials. Probably enough burial space for the next 50 years.
Thank you, sir. Could you tell us a little history of the two shuls that were combined?
Yes.
Well, what are you doing?
The Beis HaMidrash HaGadol Synagogue was founded by charter in 1893. In the Court of Common Pleas of Allegheny County. At that time, the nonprofit charters had to be, petitions had to be filed in the Common Pleas Court. And I have here in front of me a photocopy of the original charter signed by David Abner, old names in the city, Morris Rosenthal, but Jacob Bernstein, Jacob Solomon, Moses Margolis, Simon Miller, Aaron Rosenthal, Mendel Novinsky, Bennett Davis, and Maya Rosenthal.
Could you spell Novinsky for us?
N-O-V-I-N-S-K-Y. All lived on Chatham, Wiley, Federal, Fifth Avenue, Caldwell, and Washington Streets in the city of Pittsburgh. The synagogue was located on Washington Street, now known as Washington Place, extending from Fifth Avenue, from Chatham Street to Fifth Avenue to Bigelow Boulevard past the Civic Arena. The Beth Jacob Synagogue was formed in 1800 83. Bear with me 1 second to be sure. On the 30th day of June, 1983, also by petition to the Court of Common Pleas of Allegheny County, and they later erected a synagogue on Townsend Street, which is now has now disappeared, I believe, in the Hill District. With the redevelopment of the Hill District, the two synagogues were combined, most likely by reason of the attrition of Jewish population in the Hill District. And that happened about 1960, and together they built a new synagogue at 1230 Caldwell Street, a new location other than the location of the other two synagogues which had been torn down. The altar in the sanctuary of the Beth Amedra Synagogue, as it now stands, was taken from the original synagogue. So I'm not sure whether it was the Beth Jacob Synagogue or the Beth Amedra Synagogue Synagogue. Most likely the Beth Jacob Synagogue, which was founded about 10 years earlier. And the Consolidated Synagogue continues to function rather flourishingly until the present time.
Mr. Goldstein, you gave us the names of the incorporators of the one synagogue. Do you happen to have the record of the man who founded the second?
The names of the incorporators of the Beth Jacob Synagogue were Philip Cohen, C-O-H-A-N, Lazarus Levy, R.B. Wisanski.
How do you spell that?
W-I-S-A-N-S-K-Y. D. C. Bloom, D. Goldman, M. Lazdersky, L-A-S-D-E-R-S-K-Y, J. Marlin, and S. Marks.
Was Bloom B-L-O-O-M?
B-L-O-O-M,
thank
yes.
You.
All of whom signed the original charter application on the 13th day of June, 1883.
So it's a little older than the Beth Amedra.
There was, however, another synagogue in Pittsburgh. Known as the Beth Jacob Congregation. The other was known as the Beth Jacob Congregation of Pittsburgh, and this synagogue was chartered in 1902, but I am unable to distinguish whether or not what happened to one of the two Beth Jacob congregations. In any event, this synagogue was chartered by the following people, all of whom lived on, most of whom lived on the Hill District, there as follows: G. Rapport, L. Abramovitz, A. Goldman, D. S. Osgood, M. Goldberg, G. Kaplan with a C, Z. Barrack, B-A-R-A-C-H, Philip Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R, J. Weisberg, B. Amdursky, S. Perlstein, James Cohen, J. Greenwald, J. Sekolofsky, S-A-K-O-L-O-F-S-K-Y, H. Stein, and M. Rubin, all of whom signed the application for the charter. At that time, I'm uncertain where the synagogue was going to be situated, inasmuch as the charter was secured before the location of the synagogue was eventually established. Some of the old ancient archives may have this information, especially a compilation of Hebrew organizations in a book owned now by Dr. Norman Cohen, to whom I referred you sometime previously.
Thank you, sir. To change the direction and perhaps bring it a little more up to date, we were interested that you had indicated that some of your decisions have become the basis of current laws in Pennsylvania in the insurance field. We'd be interested in your sharing with us a little of that history.
Yes. I've had some rather interesting cases involving life insurance. One of which was the case of the Pennsylvania Mutual Life against Julia Bailey, B-E-L-E-Y. In this case, the insurance company had issued a policy of life insurance on a young boy who eventually was drafted into the military during the Korean War. And the policy contained a provision that it was not payable in the event death occurred in time of war. Young Bailey was killed in action by an enemy sniper on the field of battle sometime around 1950 or 51. And the insurance company refused to pay the proceeds of the policy. We filed suit in county court here on the theory that we were not engaged in a war in Korea, and in addition to that, the death of the soldier was accidental, even though the act of the enemy was intentional. We prevailed through the Superior Court of Pennsylvania and the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, and it went to the United States Supreme Court on petition for certiorari, which is a request for leave to appeal, and the Supreme Court refused to hear it, meaning that the decision of the Supreme Court to the effect that we were not in time of war was the law of the land. In my research, it developed that between 1798 and 1960, we had sent troops to various Latin American and European and African countries on 168 different occasions. We got that information from the State Department. And on each of those incursions into enemy territory, for whatever reason, there was no declared war. But the troops were sent at the command of the President of the United States, then President, because he's commander-in-chief of the military forces and had the prerogative to send troops all over the world to quell uprisings and theoretically to protect American citizens and American property abroad. So this established a precedent that unless Congress declared war, we were not at war. And that gave rise to the theory that any time we sent troops abroad, such as in Korea, in Vietnam. We were engaged in a cleanup or a police action.
What year was that?
Sir?
What year was that case?
Case was
1950.
The action started in 1950.
It was concluded by the Supreme Court on June the... It was filed in the Supreme Court on June the 22nd, 1953, and the certiorari was denied shortly thereafter in the same year. I've had some other interesting situations involving life insurance contracts, especially the case I remember having known as the case of Thompson against the Equitable Life Insurance Company, when the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania established the precedent that until the beneficiary of a policy became aware of the existence of the policy, the 6-year statute of limitations didn't apply. In this particular case, Thompson was an employee of the United States Steel Company, or the Carnegie Illinois Steel Works in Clairton, Pennsylvania, and died of tuberculosis in 1947. His widow went to the mill office to inquire about his group life insurance, and they told her that his life insurance was not in force, or that he had no life insurance. Some 18 years later, she discovered several policies of group life insurance certificates in an old trunk, and came to me, and we filed suit against the Equitable on the theory that the policies were, the statute of limitations didn't commence to run until the beneficiary became aware of the existence of the contract. And we won that case in the Supreme Court on the theory, on that theory, and collected interest for the whole period of time, that from the time of his death until the time of the final payment of the judgment. Another interesting case we had was a case involving a mysterious disappearance. As you may be aware, the law provides that when an individual disappears under mysterious circumstances, you've got to wait 7 years to have him pronounced legally dead. In the case of Londrino against the Equitable Life, Londrino was an employee of the U.S. Steel Corporation at the Cary Furnace in Rankin, Pennsylvania, working on loading blast furnaces, which, if you are familiar with the construction of a blast furnace, the material is hauled to the top of the blast furnace, was limestone, coke, and iron ore in larry cars, and dumped into the top into what were known as the bell. And the larry car comes to rest at the below the floor of the stockhouse, so to speak, where they load these larry cars. And on one particular afternoon, Londrino left home, went to work, and disappeared at 5:30 in the afternoon from his place of employment. Has never been heard from since. It happened that he had just been married some 6 or 8 months before and went to Atlantic City on his honeymoon and took a picture of himself and his wife along the rail of the boardwalk in Atlantic City, which he carried in his wallet. After his disappearance, the Steel Corporation, anxious to know what happened to him, went through the fly ash of the blast furnace and it's dumped in Snowden and hand sifted about 240 tons of fly ash.
See.
And they found a needle in a haystack. They found a half of the photograph that he carried in his wallet. And we were able to establish then that he died in the blast furnace by having fallen into the pit and hoisted into the blast furnace. That's we had that subject of an article in the Insurance Law Journal called The Case of the Missing Steelworker. This story was published, or this case rather, in the October 1956 issue of the Insurance Law Journal, which carries a lot of cases and things of interest. And we wrote that up in this particular publication. I used to write extensively for the Insurance Law Journal. In July 1953, they published the case involving Bailey against the Equitable, which was the war clause in life insurance contracts. And you will be surprised how young looking I was at those days.
Could you tell me how to spell Londrino?
L-O-N-D-R-I-N-O.
Thank you.
You have a cartoon of Cy Hungerford's over your desk.
Yeah, Hungerford drew that cartoon after the decision came down from the Supreme Court in the Bailey case, because our casualties were extremely heavy, and we thought we were at war. And the cartoon depicts an insurance policy yelling across the Pacific to Uncle Sam, saying, "Is that a war over there?"
For the record, would you tell us who Cy Hungerford was?
Cy Hungerford was a very famous international cartoonist employed by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for a long term of years, I think something like 40 or 50 years. And I believe he left this earth some 8 or 10 years ago at a rather substantial age, around 90, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Thank you.
Another interesting theory that was became the law of Pennsylvania was the determination of what is sickness. Many health and accident insurance companies, and this is a subject of an article in the Insurance Law Journal in December of 1958, many insurance companies wrote life health policies paying benefits for accidental injuries or illness or sickness. And the question arose in the case of Bradley against the Reserve Life Insurance Company in 1955, of what was the definition of sickness. Bradley had contracted some disease many years before, which was latent or incipient. And at the time of the case in question, he became bedridden as a result of the illness or the condition. And we took the position that his sickness commenced at the time he became totally disabled, not when the germs of the disease entered his body, so to speak. And he was latently suffering from that particular disease. So the courts held that sickness meant the time when you became disabled from whatever cause of any illness and unable to pursue the duties of your occupation, rather than when the original disease was contracted and which did not disable you. I'm sure there's a picture in here too. There should be a picture. Unfortunately, there's no picture. I'm still pretty young looking.
You look very young in these pictures in the Law Journal.
Since 1936, I became involved in many cases of group life insurance. Group life insurance had its inception in the United States around the year 1918, and I believe the first company to write group life insurance was the Equitable Society, and they insured employees of the Carnegie Illinois Steel Corporation, forerunner of the U.S. Steel Corporation. There apparently was very little group life insurance law in Pennsylvania until 1938-39, when I became involved in a great number of insurance cases under the group plan issued by the Equitable Society. And the language is rather loose. There had never been any final determination. But one of the provisions in the early group policies was that the insurance company would pay the benefit at any time upon proof of disability or death being supplied to the insurance company. And the first case I had was the case Sutinen, S-U-T-I-N-E-N versus the Equitable, involving a man who had been dead some 7 or 8 years, and his widow found the policy, he made claim against the society for the proceeds, and the language of the policy provided that at any time after proof of disability, the company will pay, and death ensuing, the company will pay. And we discovered that Mr. Sutinen had developed tuberculosis, which was a common disease in those days, especially in mill towns where there were coke ovens because of the exudations of the carcinogenic substances from the coke ovens, the tar substances. In any event, we pressed the claim, and the language at any time meant what it said, and we collected on that. After we collected that, the word got around that these group policies were valuable, and hundreds of people who had group policies, whether living or dead, fished them out and brought them to me. And as a result of that, I had a considerable amount of litigation and established principally the law of group life insurance in Pennsylvania between the years 1937 until 1965, roughly. And I wrote a series of articles for the Insurance Law Journal beginning in 1947, the only one of which I can find. This was the third of a series of articles on group life insurance, published in 1947. I only have one copy left.
Thank you, sir. You certainly had an influence in your field far and above what most people would have. I appreciate you telling us about these instances.
Well, there's another interesting subject called the incontestable clause, which was the subject of a case and an article in the Insurance Law Journal. All insurance policies have what is known as an incontestable clause. That is, after 2 years from the date of issue, during the lifetime of the insured, the policy is incontestable for whatever reason, even though the insured or the applicant made false answers in the attempt and deceived the insurance company regarding the medical history of the insured. Most insurance contracts at that time had, after 2 years from the date of issue, the insured shall become incontestable. And that meant that if the insurance policy was issued on a day certain, and the insured died the next day, if the beneficiary waited 2 years to file suit, he could recover under the policy language, because it provided for 2 years after the date of issue. They then modified that contract, which is now the current language in the insurance industry, to read, after 2 years from the date of issue, during the lifetime of the insured. So he had to live 2 years. That was the subject of an article in the Insurance Law Journal, published it was about 1946. That was the subject. We lost that case, but that was the principle that was established. with respect to the number of instances of military action abroad, I have a booklet from the published by the United States government called Background Information on the Use of United States Armed Forces in Foreign Countries. As I indicated before, from 1798 until 1960, there were 168 different occasions. This was sent to me by the then senator from Pennsylvania, Hugh Scott, from Philadelphia, if you recall him. I still engage in a considerable amount of insurance litigation within the limits of my physical and mental capacity today. In fact, I have an interesting case to try on Thursday. But that's been my field, and I guess I should modestly say that I'm known as an expert in the field.
You certainly are, and looking at your office, I'm sure you're still very busy. People need your expertise.
I'm not as busy as it looks. Don't be deceived by appearances. I'm just getting lazy and sloppy.
Oh, I doubt that. Well, it looks like you have many facets. You indicated earlier that you studied and wrote poetry. Would you happen to have a copy of a poem that you would like to share with us that we could have?
Why, yes. I have a cardboard folder with material in it, if I can find it.